Before starting today's episode of Reimagining Soviet Georgia, I just want to say thank you to all of our listeners, all of our supporters, and to everybody who's shared, retweeted, or even told somebody about Reimagining Soviet Georgia. All of you are helping us do what we're doing and are helping us expand the possibilities of what this show can become. We'd also like to make an appeal. We have a Patreon page. It's patreon.com/reimagining Soviet Georgia. If you can spare just a few dollars a month, or if you know somebody who can, please tell them to check out our Patreon page and consider becoming a patron of Reimagining Soviet Georgia. Right now, more than ever, it is essential to maintain critical, engaged discussions about Georgia, the Soviet past, and what the Soviet past means in the present day. Now more than ever, the Soviet Union is being referenced all the time in the news, and so it's incredibly important to keep open critical discussions. If you can become a patron for just a few dollars a month, you can help us continue to do that and do it better. So one more time, patreon.com/reimagining Soviet Georgia. And if you have any comments, thoughts, or concerns, you can send us an email at reimagining Soviet Georgia@gmail.com or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Now on with the show. My name is Brian Gigantino, and welcome to Reimagining Soviet Georgia. Human rights. It's a term we all know, but very seldom take the time to investigate. But why should we? Aren't human rights just a set of moral standards in a world of immoral actors that everybody should defend? If that sounds too simple, that's because it is. Just like anything else, human rights have a story, and that story is political. During the Cold War, dissidents in the Soviet Union started human rights organizations as vehicles to critique the society they lived in. Georgia's first post-Soviet president, dissident, poet, and ethno-nationalist Zviad Gamsakhurdia, founded the first human rights organization in Soviet Georgia in the 1970s. When the USSR collapsed, human rights discourse, exclusively focused on the rights of individuals, supplanted the politics of 20th century socialist regimes that foregrounded collective economic rights of their citizens. Western-led globalization and neoliberalism became so intertwined with human rights that they became a tool in opposition to political demands and social guarantees that questioned neoliberal excess in the post-Cold War era. On today's episode, myself and Sopo Japaridze explore this history of human rights with our guest, Samuel Moyne, professor and author of the book, Not Enough, Human Rights in an Unequal World. Samuel Moyne, welcome to Reimagining Soviet Georgia. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So could you just please introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do?
I'm Samuel Moyne. Most people call me Sam, and I teach history and write about it. Right now I'm teaching at Yale Law School, where I have classes on constitutional law and international law. And I also teach in the Yale History Department, where I have classes on contemporary global history. I've written some books about European thought and human rights and international humanitarian law, so-called. And right now I'm trying to finish some lectures about Cold War liberalism and its legacies. So that's, you know, I live in New Haven, Connecticut. I, you know, not much more interesting to say.
You love dogs, cats. No, I'm just kidding.
I do have a dog.
So maybe we can begin with, I mean, you've written a few books. I personally, how I got introduced to you actually is through Not Enough, Human Rights Aren't Enough. And that was actually a funny story. I'll say it quickly. I was a Human Rights Watch person was here, and I was telling them how I'd been playing with the Angram viewer. I had said how socialism was like exactly correlated to socialism's like decline to human rights, like you know, increase or whatever. And she was like, "Do you know Samuel Moyn?" I was like, "No." Like, you need to read his book, because I think that's exactly what he's talking about. And so, like, everything I would say, she's like, "You need to read his book." And so, like, I got your book. And since then, I've been like, you know, like, I love your work. It's amazing. And I want more people to know about it. And so why did you write this book, like, The Intellectual History of Sort of Human Rights?
Well, so I wrote a prior one, and Not Enough was in some ways a kind of redo. That earlier one is from 2010. It's called The Last Utopia. And in retrospect, the funny thing is that I wrote it in 2008-09, right during the kind of global financial meltdown. But, you know, as the impact of that kind of proceeded over the, you know, 2010s, I realized that I hadn't really given adequate attention in The Last Utopia to the distributive and economic. So I was supposed to write a sequel to The Last Utopia, since it kind of ends abruptly in around 1980. And instead, I decided to kind of rewrite it from scratch to think about the long-term relationship between human rights and political economy. And I'd also push further forward towards the present in it. And, you know, now the funny thing is that I wrote that one in, I guess, 2020, you know, 15, 16, right when the so-called populist wave was becoming very prominent. I think there's a connection, obviously, between the economic story of Not Enough and current politics, but we can get into that. But the basic reason I wrote Not Enough is because I wanted to bring the history of distributional ideals and the history of political economy more into the way we talk about where human rights came from.
So if you could just, for our audience, what are human rights?
Sure. So, you know, I assume human rights are basically the idea that individuals have some list of entitlements in virtue of being human. And the big story I've told, and it doesn't change much over the years, is that there was a big update to human rights in the 1970s-ish. You know, let's call it Human Rights 1.0 got rebooted as Human Rights 2.0. The same idea is there. That is to say, individuals have some list of entitlements on the basis of being human, but the political meaning transmogrifies. So Human Rights 1.0 are revolutionary human rights. They're associated with the American and French Revolution, and then globally with, let's call it, liberal state formation and national emancipation. And the basic idea is, you say your universal rights are getting violated in order to have a local revolution. And your goal is sovereignty locally. and the creation of a citizenship space in which you can get your entitlements. And it's not for everyone, it's for your people. And you can use violent tools to get it. And Human Rights 2.0 kind of reverses a lot of that original meaning. So it's still the case that human rights are in name for everyone, but they become much more about decentering the sovereign state and especially nation state, subordinating it to international law, which typically can actually mean neo-imperial relations, since not everyone has an equal say in what international governance means, and that is especially true in a neoliberal age. And violence is renounced, and human rights become much more about kind of long distance identification, naming and shaming despots, lawsuits, for those who like law. And so it's something new. It's in a sense more cosmopolitan, not just in deference to the fact that the idea was always universal, but also in political form. And yet it's different. And I try to argue in Not Enough that it's especially different in its relationship to distribution and political economy. And so that's the big story I tell in all of my books, kind of 1.0 to 2.0.
Okay, so can we maybe then go to sort of Helsinki and like the changes? Because I mean, we're a Reimagining Soviet Georgia podcast, so we really are trying to connect all these pieces to what happened during the Union and afterwards, since a lot of leaders after the Soviet Union collapsed were these so-called human rights defenders, like Zviad Gamsakhurdia was the first president who ended up violating more human rights than many other many others. Yet he was sort of one of the the golden boys of human rights. So maybe like discuss that and how that was sort of used as a political tool, like how that was politicized, I guess.
Absolutely. So, central to any story, including mine, of the human rights in the latter part of the 20th century and then our own century, is the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc generally. It's not the only important place. Latin America was of great importance in the same period, but I think most of us who really look hard, not so much at the 1940s, which have been tagged, I think, as a kind of origin point of human rights. And in fairness, there was this Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, which, if you want, we can get back to. But the 70s story, 30 years later, is completely bound up with East European history because of a few factors. One is that there was this diplomatic action, basically involving so-called détente between the superpowers to kind of calm down the Cold War, and that was something that, due to kind of domestic uprising, it's been argued, both sides of the Cold War split, the Americans and the Soviets, wanted. And they kind of got together and forged this treaty, which was basically seen by the Soviets as a huge win, because it ratified their takeover of Eastern Europe, which had been contested since the 1940s. And yet, largely due to West Europeans, this third basket was placed in this treaty called the Helsinki Accords, which was about kind of honoring human rights. And that had like some really unexpected implications, because some folks in Eastern Europe, we call dissidents, having tried to renovate Marxism in the 60s, you know, climactically in the Prague Spring of 1968, calling for Marxism with a human face, they glom onto human rights in general, but the Helsinki Accords in particular, and found some of the most famous human rights groups, really the first to be self-styled human rights outfits. Things like this Committee for Human Rights in the Soviet Union, and in Czechoslovakia, Charter 77, which is really formed in direct response to the Helsinki Accords. And in my story, at least, what unites all of these forces is that they're coalitional. They involve lots of different kinds of people, including like some Christians and some kind of proto-liberals, but also some reforming socialists. And the latter group kind of think that they can't like challenge the regime anymore. If you do, you're shut down. That's what the Prague Spring kind of proved. Reform socialism is not available any longer. It's no longer plausible. But, you know, these regimes have said they care about human rights. For example, in even before the Prague Spring, the Helsinki Accords, the Soviet Union publishes in Pravda the text of the main human rights covenants, which date from 1966, and which the Soviet Union ratifies very quickly in the later 1960s. And so, you know, human rights seem like something you can use to engage in a moral critique of the government in on the grounds that they said that human rights are supposed to matter now. And it doesn't seem like you're, you know, posing a fundamental challenge in the way that reformist versions of communism would to the regime. You're kind of asking it to, you know, live up to ideals it's accepted. And obviously the regime's cracked down on some of these folks, who become world famous because people in the West see them as moral heroes, you know, the Andrei Sakharovs and Václav Havels and so forth. You know, they get a lot of success in undermining the legitimacy of these regimes. I think the really interesting question is what happens after 1989? And we can get into that if you want, because many of those who have stood up for human rights are like apolitical. In a way, you know, the prehistory of 1989 is in these years when people have kind of posed as apolitical on principle. They're just for these moral ideals, which everybody supposedly accepts, including the regimes themselves. And especially the socialists among them have kind of forsaken any programmatic alternative to kind of the regime, because you can't have one or you'll be shut down. You might be shut down even as dissidents, but at least you're kind of claiming common ground, and you might survive, and you'll get a lot more backing in the West while doing so. When 1989 comes, there's this open question: what will happen? And it's kind of amazing that, you know, the best research has shown that it is a pretty open question. A lot of the prime actors, you know, elites, don't know what they want. Some think it's going to be an opportunity to revive Marxism with the human face. But of course, what's interesting is that the region goes neoliberal. And of course, there's a lot of help from, you know, very important internal actors who, you know, have, let's say, converted from being just human rights dissidents to being economic liberals. And there's also tons of help you know, from the West, you know, economic experts who parachute in to engage in shock therapy, recommend it. And of course, international financial institutions like the IMF and the World Bank that counsel rapid privatization of state assets, you know, which we know where that leads, and a you know, strong protection of property rights without social protection. And this arguably kind of casts the die for our future. You know, the debate is really like, do we blame human rights for the outcome? How did they get tangled up in these outcomes? Was it a matter of kind of confusion or, you know, ill will? You know, and that's where the debates about this have centered. And I'm kind of, let's say, I'm not the harshest critic of human rights, but I really want to show that that human rights couldn't coexist with a renewal of socialism and did get entangled in neoliberal outcomes globally, but, you know, in Eastern Europe in pretty clear ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So another, to go back to the Helsinki Accords. So there is like now a thing where they can like document, they can write the like whatever grievance, you know, that you can even take pictures and they can send it somewhere, right? So there's like a channel that's working now, right? They can actually air.
Right.
So, and it's interesting. Okay, so what, first, I find it astounding that the Soviet Union thought this was a victory. I mean, this is like the craziest thing looking at it now. But the second is, so US or any country doesn't have that same mechanism, right? So it's not like there's like tons of human rights abuses in the US, but who is there to listen to it? Where is a grievance filing? And it's like become right. Like a center stage where only the Soviet Union and only sort of civil and political rights mostly, right, are being sort of overused in the category of human rights, right, where they sort of dominate.
Right.
And only one country is being put to trial. I mean, what it looks like, I mean, to me, you know, looking at it, which further solidifies, I think, this in Georgia, especially, right, like so in post-communist countries, this like sort of obsession to thinking the West is this really moral, amazing place, like it's sort of like, it's like a fantasy of, you know, the good guys and who do everything perfect, and Soviet Union is this like horrid, you know, well, I don't even want to get into the totalitarian and all the other words that people use and genocide and things they throw around, they've made it seem like the Third Reich, but it really becomes, because there's no audience, there's no protocol, there's nothing to hold any kind of Western human rights abuses, you know, accountable. And so there's nothing to see, like, what are you going to, you know, where are you going to see? Well, they're only seeing that what the West cares about human rights here, right? They're the good guys. Like, and it's interesting because we just had on a speaker that discussed what is it called? The Scottsboro Boys, which actually the Soviet Union played a role in saving like young Black boys from being murdered, you know? So it's like a really interesting how we go from the Soviet Union being a center of sort of being trying to fight injustices worldwide to now being the culprit. Like, it's like they switched the entire moral code. It's like the Nietzschean thing where they turn the upside down of like, what is good is now bad, what is bad is now good. You know, it's kind of, it blows my mind to think about this.
Or just to add just one final thing in this point too, is that when we were discussing the Scottsboro Boys case, we were also discussing the career of William Patterson, who was one of the authors of the We Charge Genocide to the United Nations. And so it was interesting thinking about some of this discourse, and especially in the post-Soviet world around, you know, the term genocide, thinking about it sort of paralleling in certain ways in terms of political utility, the terms human rights, because when William Patterson tries to get the United Nations to recognize the treatment of African Americans in the, you know, as victims of genocide. Of course, this is swept aside as being a communist plot that has no basis in legitimacy. And then that sort of anti-communism will then affect how the globe is even able to deal with or politically utilize concepts like human rights or, in this case, genocide.
You know, I love that that framing, and I'll just kind of add, you know, pile on and add. I mean, it's really crucial to think about this 70s moment and since to go back, because not just in the 20s when you have the Scottsboro case, but in the 40s, there's just a genuine debate about who stands for justice. And it's not obvious because, you know, you have like emerging claims about Soviet totalitarianism, but then African Americans, many of whom are, if not communists, interested in it because of its anti-racism, say, well, what about American totalitarianism in the form of like the very kinds of laws that the West went to war against Adolf Hitler, you know, to rip up? And no one's moving against them. And, you know, William Patterson, you know, communist, is a great example of someone who sees the opportunity to exploit this hypocrisy. When the West controls the United Nations and the Soviets, you know, exercise vetoes in the Security Council, but there just aren't enough states on its side to really make it anything other than a Western forum. And, you know, William Patterson and so many others, W.E.B. Du Bois, who files an anti-lynching petition around human rights, they all get shut down. And yet at the time, human rights are still, I think, in that first version. And for that reason, the big event of the 40s is that the Universal Declaration reflects a kind of consensus that, you know, everyone wants a welfare state. The Universal Declaration, with American agreement, not just under Soviet pressure, you know, includes economic and social guarantees, rights to work, right to education, healthcare, and so forth. And what's really significant, as you suggested, is that when we get to the 1970s, it's as if all that's been forgotten. The Universal Declaration becomes famous amongst dissidents and their Western advocates. And yet it's as if the second half of the Universal Declaration is lopped off, and international human rights 2.0 become about civil liberties. Now, why was that plausible to people? Well, one reason is that, you know, it's the era where the you know, dark sides of the Soviet system are kind of, you know, are being emphasized yet again. This is the era of the enormous resonance of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. And at the same time, as people observe, the United States has had a civil rights revolution. Now, we look back and say it only provided formal equality. You know, it did nothing in thinking about, you know, the class basis of racism. And as a result, you have, you know, de facto segregation of schools, public schools, instead of de jure a segregation, not to mention police brutality and mass incarceration, is being built, a kind of new Gulag archipelago for Black people in the United States, in the very era in which, you know, all of these claims about Soviet human rights violation, communist evil, are more successful because, you know, the formal equalization of African Americans has changed the optics. And so it's just a very different situation in the world than the time of the Scottsboro Boys or William Patterson. And what's significant there is that class is lost, not just class, but, you know, even just the very bare minimum of socioeconomic protection, which economic rights, you know, like some food, some housing are supposed to guarantee, get forgotten. And, you know, I don't think we can defend that now. We just have to recognize that for the last 20 years of the Cold War, there was this libertarianism in human rights that ascends just at the same time that neoliberalism and economics is kind of, you know, kind of gearing up for world conquest, because, you know, it does require 1989 for that, you know, your whole region east, you know, east of the so-called Iron Curtain to get colonized by the neoliberal governance assumptions. And that's why we really have to think hard about, well, how do we connect this libertarian understanding of human rights, which is in the ascendant after the 1970s, with the neoliberal, you know, breakthrough of 1989 and since.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So I have a story where the president had a fund here, and I don't think I had realized to the level. So I lived in the U.S. This is why, like, I lived in the U.S. for 22 years. I was born in Georgia, but then went there and came back. And so, like, you know, I hadn't witnessed, I had learned more of sort of Latin American examples and understanding. And I didn't realize, like, how conservative right wing the ideology was here to the level that it is. It's really, it is, like, I call it a libertarian paradise here, right? And so we had written, like, the labor law changed. I'm a labor leader here. I run a union, a service sector union. And so I had written to try to, like, nobody understood, like, labor code. So I was like, maybe we can make this, like, more accessible to people because they're not going to read a legal document. So, like, let's do a, you know, some kind of a comic book or something to make it, you know, easy for workers. And the president, they had, like, a call out for human rights proposals. And I was like, labor right. Okay. You know, and, this woman wrote me back and she said, oh, I'm sorry, this is labor. We're only funding human rights.
Right.
This is the presidential, grant fund that didn't know that human rights was not only civil and political, which is, like, wow. Like, and I wrote back, I was like, and I quoted, like, I sent the entire Universal Declaration of Human Rights to her. I was like, why don't you read it? Because I don't think you know what human rights are before you start, like, giving out grants to people you don't even understand. I was
totally
angry. Like, but this is, like, no one really knows that social and economic rights are, you know, or collective rights in the same, in the sense of, are, like,
sure,
are human rights. And it's so, it's, and it's, like, it's important too, because neoliberalism, like, when you go, actually, I want you to talk about that more, about, like, sort of sufficiency and this idea of equality being sort of killed off in the process, because that shows, right, like, you know, every facet, every program that's designed here is under these neoliberal guidelines of just enough to survive, you know, like, just physiological survival and never about development besides that. You know, they're trying to, like, make sure nobody likes living under $2 a day or has just the basic, you know, even the less than basic services just to survive, but never actually reach equality or even, like, you know, the so-called middle class doesn't even exist really. So maybe you could discuss that, how you came to even figure, you know, understand what was happening.
Absolutely. So, you know, I wanted to reckon with, you know, this core insight of yours that it really takes a long time for people to you know, recall that economic and social rights were once part of the picture of human rights. And, you know, one reason I wrote the book is to actually just give a sense of the history of these ideas of economic rights all the way back to the French Revolution, and in, you know, labor movements in the 19th century and the kind of makings of the, you know, transatlantic welfare state in the middle of the 20th. But by the 1970s and 80s, they're gone. And, you know, Human Rights Watch, which, you know, begins as Helsinki Watch, you know, to participate in this annual monitoring process to which you alluded, where people could kind of, like, report back on how things are going in, you know, not in every country, but in communist countries. They just conveniently forget about the economic and social rights, which aren't just in, you know, in history, but in the Universal Declaration that they say they're defending. And so that's just incredibly important, because long into the period since 1989, that simplification has been made. Take the case of George Soros, who is born, you know, in Hungary, comes to the United States, becomes fabulously wealthy, and becomes the greatest funder of human rights activism everywhere, like by far, through the Open Society Foundations, which he founds. You know, it's named after a book by Karl Popper, which emphasizes freedom from the state, not the idea that the state plays a role in ensuring our freedom through social provision. And, you know, Soros, you know, funds tons of groups that then means that if an individual wants to apply anywhere in the world to support human rights, he may face, or she may face, the answer you're given, that economic rights aren't human rights, because that's not what the open society is supposed to involve. And so that really dies hard. But I didn't want to limit the argument there, because it's only fair to note that, especially in the global South since 1989, there's been huge pressure to like resurrect economic rights from the dead. And even the kind of mainstream human rights organizations in the global North, like Human Rights Watch, have taken on board slowly and inadequately the fact that these are rights too. So I crafted a kind of different argument to take account of this fact. And, it, you know, you've alluded to it. The basic idea is that economic and social rights are threshold concepts. They say on the basis of their humanity, people get enough of the good things in life that everyone requires, you know, some kind of job, some kind of housing, some kind of, you know, food, some kind of sanitation. These aren't egalitarian. I call them a sufficiency norms, because they say, let's bring the floor up so people aren't living on the bare ground. And again, that's good relative to saying nothing about distribution, because everyone does need these basic decencies. The question is, what else we're committed to do? And many of our ancestors, you know, in especially in the era of welfare states and under communism, said things like, well, okay, poverty is bad, but so is inequality, which is a different thing. And it's not okay to build a floor if you're simultaneously letting any ceiling on inequality be neglected or even obliterated. And the trouble is, that's exactly what's happened in our neoliberal era, that very often we've built floors, we built very low floors, especially if we take the World Bank's extreme poverty measure of a dollar and change a day, or we've built more generous floors through things like human rights activism. But meanwhile, neoliberalism has destroyed the ceiling on inequality. So class power has been exacerbated even as poverty has been remediated. And that's bad. So, you know, the basic argument of not enough is that human rights are good, but not if they mean the exacerbation of class power. And we need to make, you know, our idealism more ambitious so that we care not just about, you know, these sufficiency norms, as important as they are, but like the whole distributional picture and the whole question of like who exercises power over whom on the basis of accelerating economic inequality.
I think it's in the second to last chapter of your book, you've got this, you discuss this relationship between human rights and neoliberalism, and you try to respond to the accusation that human rights were like responsible for reinforcing neoliberalism, as opposed to them being sort of
right,
fellow travelers. And I was wondering if you could just kind of outline that argument, because I think that there is a lot of confusion in terms of how people can assess human rights politically and its relationship
right
to neoliberalism.
Right. Well, so, you know, it's a really complex thing. And especially because we're dealing with lots of different places at different times and different scales. So we might be interested in Georgia at the national level, or we might be interested in international financial institutions which operate globally. So basically, I do try to say that these two things, human rights and neoliberalism, are definitely connected. But I want to resist like the easy out of saying, well, human rights are just a smokescreen for neoliberalism for a few different reasons. First, those sufficiency norms saying, you know, that we can appeal to economic and social rights, even if they're just about a low floor, are good things. And I don't think that it's somehow been helpful. Maybe, you know, only to the smallest extent in kind of reinforcing neoliberal breakthrough and victory, which is really caused by lots of other forces. And so I guess I kind of, you know, adopt what I'd call a more ecological view. So maybe, you know, maybe this will help consider a kind of analogy. You could imagine a jungle in which there's a super predator, you know, the kind of that's our neoliberal, you know, governance movement. And their agenda is to eliminate as the apex predator, their real challengers. So for example, socialism has to die, and it does. It's beaten, it's destroyed. There might be a butterfly in the jungle. It's not threatening. It might even be doing something to prettify this, you know, scene of carnage. Now, would we blame the butterfly for the predator's victory? No. Would we say the butterfly is a distraction? Maybe. It's not like the distraction, you know, caused the predator to rule. Maybe the predator would win anyway. But certainly we need a challenger to the predator. We can't just prettify the jungle. And my basic take on human rights is it's the butterfly. It's not like it's bad, it's even good, but it's not enough. That's the title of the book. And so what I try to show is that, you know, human rights played a variety of roles. Before 1989, it did delegitimize socialism. There's just no doubt about that. And the whole idea of socialism died with communism. But once 1989 happens, you know, it's doing some noble work. You know, there are some despotic and repressive regimes in the former Soviet zone. But at the same time, it's at best in that environment working on a sufficiency floor, even as like unprecedented economic inequalities are what really get entrenched. And human rights have nothing to say about that, you know, predatory victory.
No, it's interesting. We recently had on Kristen Gotze and Mitchell Ornstein, who wrote Taking Stock of Shock in the Post-Communist Countries. And it was like interesting because in the sense that like what you're saying about human rights working in these sort of limited ways in a certain very like despotic regime, a lot of even the libertarian neoliberal experiments were still very contained in these small ways, you know, Chile being sort of the big one, you know, which we know how, right, you know, violence had to be committed to even achieve neoliberal policies in Chile. But really it was like, there was like neoliberal reforms within a welfare state or pseudo welfare states. When communism fell, it opened up entire uncharted swaths of, you know, territory and country, entire countries, where it wasn't these little tiny things to do, but these like very untested, you know, maybe specific to certain things, were unleashed on millions and millions of people completely unmitigated. And it's like terrifying that people who had no experience in any of this or really knew anything about it, just unleashed this like shock doctrine, and with it, the human rights, the butterfly, right, to like make it a little bit better. It was like, here's a little Western funding. All it did was just create a middle class here that's funded solely by international organizations and donors that are very loyal to the West, right? Why everybody hates them. And so, well, my friend says we had to survive. You know, she's always like, we had to survive. We took money from anyone, which is understandable when it's like such devastation, you know? And so if you weren't being paid by the state, then you had to get paid by somebody, and there was no like businesses really. And so I don't feel like people really appreciate the scale of what happened, you know? And I feel like that's still not really, like there's like, you are, you know, Kristen, like there's a few people are attempting to piece together these huge changes, but it still feels like it's not really mainstream yet, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. You know, I'm looking forward now to the next phase of thinking, because I feel like across the world we're finally like coming out of this hangover from the 1990s when we drank the, you know, ultimately, you know, very, I think, heady brew of like the end of history and neoliberal orthodoxy. And we can see that we many people made a mistake, but we haven't really come to terms with what happened while we, you know, were under the influence. And we don't have great books yet, you know, some good ones that kind of just take account of the devastation, let alone propose a way out. And so it's I think a kind of really interesting moment when at least the intelligentsia are recognizing that there was a disastrous mistake made in just like mainstream assumptions about, you know, the future and the nature of the good life and the role of the state and the you know, the significance of, you know, deterritorialized wealth and so many other things. And, you know, there's a reckoning now, and we don't know what form it will take and where it will lead, but it's coming.
I don't know if you will agree with it. I know you wrote this book earlier, but I felt like this got like a boost, like especially within these, even these international human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch or Open Society, where you were, you know, I feel like they have listened to you in some ways. I've watched Open Society sort of take on more economic stuff recently, and I feel like you really influenced them. I mean, that's just like my conjecture. But also I really think the young guard, as I understood how it was described to me, is the younger people working there were influenced by sort of Bernie Sanders and like Elizabeth, some of them it's Elizabeth Warren, and this like a little bit, you know, AOC. And I feel like that helped, that kind of Bernie moment kind of shaped a lot of young people who are working in a lot of these human rights organizations to have at least like a reckoning with the older anti-communist like guard that focused mostly on these like civil. So I do feel like there's like there's something going on, there's brewing, you know. It's too bad that the Bernie Sanders sort of moment might be completely over for right now, but that gave a huge opening internationally. I don't feel like people realize how important American politics is. Like, that gave like a breathing space we haven't had in so long to even discuss some of these issues like taxing the rich. And it's become like common now to like pretty much curse out Elon Musk for like paying taxes, you know, like even though there's like the right crazy libertarians who just love him and, you know, die for him and so on. But that is important to have, you know, you have these ideas like you do, like I do, other people. And then these moments give us openings, right, to make it more mainstream, to reach more people. And like Bernie really helped. It really, really, I feel like gave a, you know, respite of neoliberalism. It was really like, it's horrible for a long time. But as far as, you know, what happens here? I just wanted to comment on a lot of times these reforms are coming down the pipe from, you know, World Bank or whatever, even human rights organizations are never questioned because they're assumed sort of value neutral. And that's a huge problem where we try to explain these are actually ideological because they're assuming like communism is ideological and the non-ideology is the West, right? And it's so frustrating because if they don't have those like ability, they don't have those skills to identify what's actually not value neutral or have, this is actually what neoliberalism is when you organize around efficiency and cost effectiveness and like sufficiency, that's neoliberalism and not what people need, you know? And so like your book, and again, I want it to be translated. Maybe we can try to figure out how to translate your book into Georgian, actually. Really, it's so important. I think in every post-communist like languages, it should be translated because I think it's one of the only ones. And I know actually there have been, like I've read some Ukrainian like paper about women's rights, only civil rights were being funded and not all the things they needed because they didn't want people to turn back to communism or, you know, like have like material things. But there isn't that many that gives like a history then people can take as a tool to then analyze other things, you know? And so like, I don't know, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your book and I hope everyone reads it again. And also like, you know, to ask another question before we maybe wrap up soon, the Helsinki Accords, you know, like a lot of the human rights people, like I said, Kamsa Hudia, you know, like, a lot of the human rights dissidents turn out to be pretty terrible people, right? Like themselves. And that's like the nature.
Sure.
What would you say about that? I think it's an interesting phenomena that occurred to me how the connection between those two things, is there a connection maybe? Was it opportunism or?
I think so. I mean, you know, so first I'll just, you know, join in and saying, you know, the children are the future. And I think it's an incredibly, you know, it's an incredibly exciting time to see young people, you know, kind of shrug off the ideological assumptions for new ideological assumptions, since, as you say, everyone's ideological. And I've actually been surprised when I've gone into the lion's den of some of these mainstream human rights organizations and gotten bitterly attacked by the kind of old guard, to see the younger generation kind of who are inheriting these things, thinking that mistakes were made and they need to radically change the outlook of some of these organizations. And I think, you know, when you leave behind those organizations and look at kind of grassroots mobilization, it's even truer. And back to the days of Occupy Wall Street through the Sanders campaigns, which I think wrought a fundamental transformation. I think we're heading into a time of, as I say, reckoning. Now, you're right that, you know, in some places, you have this repeated phenomenon of the human rights icon turning bad. And, you know, probably the most kind of, you know, famous example right now is Aung San Suu Kyi, who was kind of canonized as a human rights heroine and then, like, demonized for not playing her expected role. I mean, I think it's very hard to generalize across the cases, but, you know, my own sense is that we should just remember that human rights are negative politics in many cases, because they're about saying that the state is failing. They're not about saying what it should do. Now, of course, you know, if we are generous to human rights, it's clear that with respect to economic and social rights and all the rest of human rights, states have positive obligations to fulfill human rights so everyone enjoys them. But there's the sense that in which, you know, those who became icons became human rights icons for denouncing evil as if, like, you know, the world is white and black. And, you know, that was troublesome because we didn't think about what would happen next once evil empires fell. These people who'd become iconic well, they didn't really have many ideas and often enough, like Václav Havel, and they were vaulted into power and in effect handed it to neoliberals, or worse in the cases, you know, like you mentioned. So this is, I think, you know, a pathological, and we can't, you know, like afford to allow those to be famous who just are rejecting power, because we want to know, well, how would you wield it if you had it?
It was interesting in the Georgian case, you kind of mentioned this first president, Gamsakhurdia, who was a human rights activist in the Soviet period and founded the Georgian Helsinki group. And it was interesting that in studying his very short-lived presidency before there was a coup that overthrew him, he was trying to get the United States to recognize him on the principles of human rights. And then immediately right. afterwards, the same month that he makes this appeal to the United States, Human Rights Watch writes this huge report saying that he's responsible for all of these human rights abuses. And so what's interesting to me too is how you guys have both mentioned this, how there's a kind of like neutralizing effect of politics with human rights, right. and neoliberalism is the premier political neutralizer. So mixed together, right. of course, this is like a fundamental attack on any political thinking or political activity in general. So I guess what's been interesting to see in Georgia was how even immediately when the independence happens, that the state's sovereignty, political life is being navigated on a plane of human rights that has no meaning. So human rights right. stand in for navigating the political, and it doesn't even have any basis in meaning. Both sides are, yep. no, this is, you know, you're the human rights abuser. No, you're the human rights abuser, and it's void of any politics. So then that sort of maintains, right, I think, in the political sphere. And so I guess this importation of like human rights is like the neutralizer of politics.
I love that. It's so eloquent. And, you know, I'll just add briefly that, you know, most human rights aren't absolute. They say there are some priorities. And then it's kind of up to us how we fit them together with each other and with our other ends, including, for example, more distributive equality rather than less. And, you know, that requires kind of a program and a political vision. And in real life, we're not going to have like pure incarnations of every principle. We're going to have different options, and it would be better, even if human rights are worth invoking, in cases of egregious violation, to kind of, when we're choosing between parties or candidates, to sort of say, well, we're in a universe where what matters is the overall program and what this option can do overall, because there's like, in the end, human rights aren't exactly a program. They're kind of, let's say, constraints that all programs should share. But we really ultimately have to focus on what we should do in comparison to something else that's worse. And that's politics, as you say. And I think human rights don't get us there.